Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Upwork has the world's largest network of independent professionals. Let me just close this real quick. So if you need a back-end developer, a UI designer, or a project manager for 6 days or 6 months, Upwork is how.
Hey, I have this room booked at noon.
I'm just wrapping up here. Upwork professionals have the flexibility and capability to work from anywhere.
Yeah, it's 1201.
Okay, it's all yours. Which is nice if you're already low on conference rooms. Plus, they're proven, rated, and reviewed. When you need in-demand talent on demand, Upwork is how.
Okay, Houston, we've had a problem here.
13 Minutes to the Moon, Season 2.
I was thinking that we weren't going to survive.
Episode 1, available now.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 10th of March, these are our main stories. Italy extends strict quarantine measures against the coronavirus to the whole country. Concern about the disease contributes to the worst day in a decade on world financial markets. Also, Sudan's Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok survives an apparent assassination attempt. Later in this podcast...
What's in the tower?
That's enough for one day. We'll visit again another time. Time to go.
Max von Sydow, star of Game of Thrones and The Exorcist, dies at 90. And we know plastics in the oceans can get tangled up with turtles, but now they've started eating them. Stay at home. That's the message from Italy's Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte. He's announced he's extending the strict coronavirus quarantine measures in place in northern Italy to the entire country.
Non ci sarà più una zona rossa.
There won't be a zone 1 or a zone 2. There will only be one Italy with a protected zone. We would then need to avoid movements across the whole territory, unless they are essential and motivated by three specific circumstances: work reasons, necessary reasons, or also health reasons. And we add to this decision a prohibition on public gatherings.
He said the measures which come into effect on Tuesday were to defend the most fragile members of society. Italy's coronavirus death toll jumped on Monday by 97 to 463. It's the worst hit country after China. Our reporter Charlotte Gallagher has been following the story.
These are extreme measures, unheard of in peacetime. But this is obviously what the authorities believe is the best course of action, given, as you said, this huge jump in the number of cases. These restrictions affecting every region and every person in Italy. So around 60 million people being told they can only travel for work or family or medical emergencies. The Italian Prime Minister saying, look, the best thing you can do is stay at home. These are going to be enforced by the police and the army. There's also going to be restrictions on international travel as well. Now, the Prime Minister said we have to make sacrifices. People might know that Italy is a very sociable country. People like to go out, see their friends, see their family. But he's saying, look, at this moment, Italy needs to change. We need to change how we do things if we're going to stop this virus. Essentially, parts of the country are shutting down. This is a major Western country. And I think what's really worrying for people is this is a country with advanced healthcare systems. And at this stage, they have so many cases of coronavirus. All schools and universities, they're closed from Tuesday until the beginning of April. Now.
And enforcing those restrictions of movement is going to be a logistical challenge, to say the least. I mean, we saw when there were much more minor restrictions on visits of family members into prisons, how they reacted. I mean, it's been extraordinary, hasn't it?
There's been chaos at prisons. Six inmates have died at various prisons in Italy because essentially, as you said, they were saying that families could no longer visit. They could only have phone conversations with their family members. People have died. They think they might have got into the medical centres in the hospital and accessed drugs and overdose. Some families are saying, we don't know if our families who are in prison are still alive because they haven't been told. So they've been gathering outside prisons. There's been inmates on the roofs. The situation could get out of control. And in fact, 50 people broke out of one prison. They've captured most of them now. So this is a situation they really need to get a handle on.
Charlotte Gallagher, or the head of the World Health Organization, has warned that the coronavirus outbreak has spread to so many countries, there's now a real risk it's going to turn into a pandemic, but that it is still possible to control it. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said the spread could be stopped through a strategy of containment and mitigation, and that all countries had the responsibility to take every measure.
Whether it kills a young person or an old person, any country has an obligation to save that person. So that's why we're saying no white flag. We don't give up. We fight to protect our children, to protect our senior citizens. At the end of the day, it's a human life.
We'll find out what's happening in one of the other countries worst affected, Iran, later in the podcast. But while understandably much of the focus has been on the number of people likely to contract coronavirus, it's having a huge impact on the financial markets too. Trading in US shares was briefly suspended after sharp falls led to an automatic halt in the selling and buying of stocks. But what impact does hundreds of billions of dollars being wiped off share prices mean for the global economy and for businesses, small and large? And crucially, what can governments do about it? Questions I put to our economics correspondent, Theo Leggett.
Well, the phrase we always use here is the markets are not the economy. What the markets can do is tell you what's happening in the outside economy and what people are scared of. And here it's pretty clear that there are two factors playing in. One of them is the sudden fall in the oil price, which is thanks to a dispute between Saudi Arabia and Russia and the resulting price war, which has brought down oil prices. The other factor, what I personally think is a bigger one, is the impact of coronavirus. So coronavirus, it's reducing production in China. We've seen parts of Italy cut off. It's hammering the tourist industry. And people are starting to realise that this isn't going to be over quickly, that it could get an awful lot worse. And that's causing an awful lot of economic nervousness. You get these factors coming together and you see what we've seen today, which is the major sell-off on the share markets. There are direct economic consequences of that. So, for example, if people have investments that are stock market-based, retirement plans, for example, that they're about to cash in, they could stand to make very serious losses. But by and large, it's worth thinking of this as an indication that investors are getting very seriously concerned about the situation and looking for safe havens for their money.
And now if, and it's a big if at the moment, the level of quarantine increases hugely over the coming weeks or months, what can individual governments do to try to help tens of thousands of small businesses from going to the wall?
Well, absolutely. As you say, it's small businesses who are, generally speaking, the most vulnerable. They have the fewest financial resources. They're often very cash flow dependent. If you look into the services sector, restaurants, for example, they're not going to be making any money if nobody's going out and having a meal. So they won't have any way to pay off any debts they might have. So what governments in these circumstances can do is try to find ways to ease the pressure on them. So, for example, encouraging banks to be a little bit softer, give them an extended time to pay, perhaps set up a fund that makes that happen. What we're very used to when you see chaos on the markets, and what we've heard a lot of discussion of over the past week, is central banks stepping in and using their financial muscle to sort things out by cutting interest rates and softening monetary policy and so on. The problem is that's a very blunt instrument and it might not be the most effective in these circumstances. So interest rates are already very low, so there's a limit to what they can do. And if people aren't producing things, if factories are unable to produce things because they haven't got staff or whatever, as we've seen in China, or if people aren't buying goods that come out of the factories, then it doesn't matter how much money and cheap credit's washing around, it's not doing a lot of good. So in these circumstances, the best thing really is to try and make sure that the businesses that come under pressure do not go under. And that means finding ways to ease the pressures on them and to help them cope with debts at a time when they may not have much in the way of revenue.
That was Theo Leggett. And as I said, we'll come back later in this podcast to hear what the coronavirus situation is like in Iran. But let's head to Sudan now, because the Prime Minister there, Abdallah Hamdok, has survived unharmed after a bomb and gun attack targeted his convoy in an apparent assassination attempt. It's not yet clear who carried out the attack, which comes after a period of dramatic political transition in Sudan. Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, reports.
For a country that's seen so much political upheaval over the last year, the news from Khartoum was deeply worrying, although not entirely surprising. That's the Sudanese Information Minister, Faisal Mohamed, confirming that the Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok's convoy was targeted by explosions and gunshots. Much to the relief of most Sudanese, he went on to say that no one was harmed in what he described as a terrorist attack. The big question is who wanted to kill the Prime Minister. To answer that, it's worth looking back at recent events, especially the downfall of the former President Omar al-Bashir last year. There were celebrations even beyond the country when protests led to the army stepping in and removing a president who, during 30 years in office, had created and unleashed numerous armed militias to ensure he remained untouchable. There then followed a tense period as the opposition continued its push to stop Sudan being taken over by the military. A compromise was reached, with men in uniforms and civilians sharing power. Not surprisingly, relations between the two are at times difficult. The Prime Minister, the former economist Abdallah Hamdok, has the tough task of ensuring the transformation to democracy stays on track. But he's bound to be making some enemies, because so many once powerful personalities continue to see their influence further eroded, especially as reforms are carried out in the security sector. That could explain what appears to be a failed assassination attempt.
Will Ross. For the very first time, Twitter has tagged a video as manipulated media, an edited clip of a speech by the presidential contender Joe Biden. It had 6 million hits and was posted by the White House director of social media and has been shared twice by President Trump. Nuala McGovern has been speaking to the BBC's Anthony Zerker, who's in southern Florida.
Manipulated or selectively edited? I mean, obviously, we're entering a kind of a new world of digital recordings and production where something can be not what it originally seems, but a less perhaps drastic version is to edit something so you don't see the full length of a clip, which is what happened in this case.
This is a version of the clip as posted by White House social media director Dan Scavino.
Turn this primary from a campaign that's about negative attacks into one about what we're for, because we cannot get re-elect. We cannot win this re-election. Excuse me. We can only re-elect Donald Trump.
Okay, you heard the last line there. We can only re-elect Donald Trump. And let's listen to a bit more of the speech, including the bit that came after what we just heard.
Campaign that's about negative attacks into one about what we're for, because we cannot get re-elect. We cannot win this re-election. Excuse me, we can only re-elect Donald Trump if, in fact, we get engaged in this circular firing squad here. It's got to be a positive campaign, so join us. Folks, we're building a coalition.
I think, or you tell me, Anthony, is this what the future of the campaign is going to be? I mean, Joe Biden, he trips over his words there, but they stopped it, obviously, before he kind of rectified what he was trying to mean.
Right, and that is something, if you listen to Joe Biden speak, you're going to see time and time again, is kind of verbal stumbles and kind of difficult locutions at time, which would lend itself to selective editing like this, where he's tripping over himself. They cut it off before you hear him say it the way he originally meant for it to come out. So I think we're definitely going to see more and more of that. If you listen to Donald Trump and his supporters, they're going to go after Joe Biden's mental acuity, I guess is the way to say it, saying that he is in his late 70s and he is not as sharp as he used to be. You hear that from Bernie Sanders supporters sometimes, too. So this is not going away anytime soon.
It is the men in their 70s that seem to be ahead, including Donald Trump. With this, you know, it comes up manipulated on Twitter. Let's talk about the swing voters, huh? The people that might vote for Trump or could vote for Biden if he is the Democratic nominee. Something like this, a manipulated tweet, would that make a difference?
You know, if it's playing into what the message that Joe Biden's opponents are trying to put forward, that he is, in fact, not as sharp as he used to be, then maybe they will take it into consideration. I was just talking to a Joe Biden supporter here at this very event a few minutes ago who said before Biden became the front runner, she had supported Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg and Kamala Harris. She really wasn't crazy about the idea of Joe Biden, thought that he was a little too old, but now she's falling in line behind him because she wants to beat Donald Trump. Now, she's a passionate supporter, a Democratic activist, but the reality is there are going to be some people who that may make a difference with.
Anthony Zerker. The 2-time Oscar nominee, Max von Sydow, has died at the age of 90. The Swedish-born actor had more than 100 roles in a career that spanned more than 6 decades. He was best known for his performances in Hollywood productions, but owed much of his earlier success to the Swedish director Ingmar Bergman. Our correspondent Vincent Dowd looks back at his work.
Max von Sydow was acting in films at 20. Before he was 30, director Ingmar Bergman gave him one of his best roles.
Vem är du?
Jag är döden.
Kommer du för att hämta mig?
Jag har redan länge gått vid
din... In The Seventh Seal, Max von Sydow was a blonde medieval knight playing chess with death. There'd be 10 more films for Bergman, including some of the director's most admired. Often, Max von Sydow was called upon to play stern characters with an air of mystery. By the 1960s, he was appearing in major Hollywood films. In The Greatest Story Ever Told, he played Jesus Christ. He thought the film slow and stiff.
My brother will go to heaven. He is a good man.
Did I say he was not good? I said he is wealthy. Where a man's wealth is, there is his heart also.
Other English-language films included The Exorcist and, in 1980, the absurdly camp Flash Gordon.
After the earthquakes and tidal waves, they won't be quite the human beings you remember. They'll be more tractable. You really prefer death to a kingdom?
He was twice Oscar-nominated, and von Sydow appeared in Game of Thrones as the mysterious three-eyed raven.
What's in the tower?
That's enough for one day. We'll visit again another time. Time to go.
Father!
Max von Sydow could suggest kindliness on screen or be coldly forbidding. The camera loved his power to communicate mystery and unknowability.
Vincent Dowd reporting. Still to come on this podcast, Prince Andrew backtracks on a deal to help out with the Jeffrey Epstein case. Back to our top story now, coronavirus. Iran is another of the worst affected countries. It's also one of the places it's been hardest to get reliable information from. Officially, Iran says the number of dead has risen to nearly 240, but the real figure is widely believed to be far higher, as I've been hearing from our correspondent, Siavash Ardalan from Persian Television.
We are getting accounts on social media, ourselves here in BBC Persian TV, from hospitals that are just, you know, carrying out massive burials of people who are dying. Hospital staff, very high fatality rate among the nurses and among the doctors who are suffering from a lack of resources. And that's the best that they could do, given the resources that they have.
So you're saying you're getting accounts of that on social media. What's the official response to that? Is that being reported on official state TV, for example?
The official state TV tries to play down the severity of the problem so as to not create panic, as if there wasn't enough panic already. And the negative effect that that's had is a lot of people are not taking it seriously. That's why you have 2 new epicenters in the northern provinces, which are tourist destinations. Many people took these warnings and the closures of schools and university as a sign that they could go on a vacation now to their villas in the northern area. Hence, now those places are worse infected and the hospitals there are worse overwhelmed. Every day, the health ministry gives the official tally, and that's through a centralized system where you see all the people who have the worst respiratory illnesses and people who have died, and they send samples to the capital. And over there, once they're confirmed, they announce those cases. But that's just the tip of that metaphorical iceberg.
So at the moment, there's no quarantine per se. People are being urged not to travel in certain areas. But what do you see as the next stage? Is there an inkling that you're getting that they're going to take it to the next stage in terms of quarantine?
They have, in effect, tried to implemented quarantine in the northern provinces. They put in some travel restrictions two nights ago. But then you have a lot of people who ignore those calls to stay home, the official repeated calls asking people, don't go out, stay home as much as you can. Many people didn't listen to that, and they made their way to those northern provinces and to those other tourist destinations. And so they had to ease some of those travel restrictions because of the social tensions that that created, because a lot of local residents in those infected areas who had already heeded those calls and stayed home, they formed angry mobs. And they went to those areas, to the borders of their localities, and stopped local tourists from entering. And we had some confrontations there. So, you know, there's a tightrope for the government to walk, and, you know, from preventing the country into descending into chaos, and at the same time containing the virus.
That was Siavash Ardalan from Persian Television. Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has called for concrete support from his NATO allies in Syria. He told the NATO Secretary General, Jens Stoltenberg, in Brussels that Turkey was making a major sacrifice in Syria, where it lost more than 50 soldiers last month. Turkey also wants more money from the EU in return for agreeing to prevent more than 3 million migrants from attempting to cross into Europe. Our Europe correspondent, Kevin Connolly, reports.
Refugees in Syria are held in Turkey under the terms of a deal in which the EU agreed to provide funds to pay for the camps there, partly for humanitarian reasons, partly to prevent migration, triggering a political crisis inside Europe. In recent weeks, President Erdogan has allowed migrants to head towards his country's border with Greece to increase pressure on Brussels to offer more. The President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, said more talks were needed and more support all round.
Migrants need support. Greece needs support, but also Turkey needs support. And this involves finding a path forward with Turkey. Clearly, we do have our disagreements, but we have spoken plainly and we have spoken openly.
The EU may find it easy enough to offer more money to Turkey, but President Erdogan has other demands too, including easier access to European visas for his citizens. That might prove more problematic. And NATO will be cautious of Turkish demands for immediate support in Syria, wary of the Russian presence, and conscious that Turkey recently annoyed its allies by buying a Russian air defence system. No single day of talks was ever going to resolve all of this, and many more rounds of negotiations may follow.
That was Kevin Connolly reporting. Millions of women in Mexico and Argentina have been staying away from their offices, schools and government departments in a one-day protest. It follows mass demonstrations against gender-based violence that saw hundreds of thousands take to the streets over the weekend. The strike comes after a number of high-profile murders of women and girls this year. Will Grant in Mexico has been speaking to some of the relatives.
Mexican women have plenty of reasons to protest. At least 10, in fact. The number of femicides which take place in the country every single day. And anger over that awful figure is reaching boiling point. In Mexico City, the International Women's Day march began peacefully for the most part. Tens of thousands of women took the opportunity to stand shoulder to shoulder and showed their frustration at what they see as a lack of action by the government of Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Gender-based violence against women has long been an issue in Mexico, but recently it has been spiralling out of control.
Women are disappearing. They're raped, they're mutilated, they're burnt, they've been found in water cisterns. And why? For breaking off a relationship? I don't think that's fair. Me and my colleagues here are demanding an end to all types of violence, and we're calling on all women to take care of themselves, to look after each other.
Some marched over the general failure to protect Mexico's women by successive administrations. Others cited specific cases. Yet everyone shared the movement's basic slogan, not one fewer.
There are many women in this situation of violence because due to a lack of resources, of care, the victims are not able to go out onto the streets and cry out. We're crying out. What do we need? For the media to know that this is not just one femicide case. There are many more.
The main criticism levelled at the women's movement is over its more radical fringe. A group of feminists reached the main square, the Zócalo, and threw paint at the National Palace and clashed with riot police, who responded with tear gas. There was also a clash with conservative anti-abortion campaigners who had turned out to oppose the march. Such is the depth of feeling over the gender-based violence in Mexico, the chance of confrontation was always likely. Now Mexican women will follow this demonstration with a national strike, in which millions will stay away from work and school under the hashtag A Day Without Us. Unless the brutal killings of women are tackled soon, it looks set to become an annual event.
Will Grant there. New research suggests that sea turtles mistake the scent of plastic for food. It had long been thought that those endangered creatures confuse plastic for prey because it resembles jellyfish. But now scientists in America have found that turtles eat it because it smells edible. Helen Briggs reports.
A plastic bag floating in the ocean can look a lot like a tasty jellyfish to a sea turtle, but this innocent mistake can cost the animal its life if it swallows plastic or gets entangled in it. Now new experiments show the relationship with plastic is more complex than previously thought. Dr. Joseph Fahler at the University of Florida says it's not just the look of plastic that confuses turtles, it's the smell.
Well, plastics that have spent time in the ocean develop smells that turtles are attracted to. And this is an evolutionary adaptation for finding food, but it has now become a problem for turtles because they're attracted to the smells from the plastics.
When plastic gets into the water, it's rapidly colonized by microbes and algae. Food-like odours are released which attract the attention of sea turtles, possibly over long distances. The same might be true of fish and seabirds. With plastic rapidly accumulating in the oceans, scientists say understanding more about this deadly attraction is critical for protecting sea turtles and other marine life.
Helen Briggs. Prince Andrew has been accused by a US prosecutor of declining to cooperate with investigators in the Jeffrey Epstein case. Epstein, who was a convicted sex offender, was a friend of Prince Andrew, who has stepped back from public duties but denies claims of sexual misconduct. More from our Washington correspondent, Nick Bryant.
For months now, New York prosecutors have grown increasingly frustrated with what they see as the lack of cooperation from Prince Andrew with their ongoing investigation into his one-time friend Jeffrey Epstein. Now they're saying he has completely shut the door on assisting U.S. investigators. The Manhattan U.S. attorney, Jeffrey Berman, complained in January that Prince Andrew had not made good his promise last year to help the U.S. authorities. Now he's delivered his strongest criticism to date. Contrary to Prince Andrew's very public offer to cooperate with our investigation into Epstein's co-conspirators, he said, an offer that was conveyed via press release, Prince Andrew has now completely shut the door on voluntary cooperation and our office is considering its options. Prince Andrew is not under any legal obligation to assist the FBI or lawyers representing Jeffrey Epstein's victims. But under something known as mutual legal assistance, New York prosecutors could issue a formal request for the prince to give evidence in the UK.
Now, for the BBC World Service's latest podcast, we're going back exactly 50 years.
Suddenly there was a big bang.
An explosion in the depths of space.
Okay, Houston, we've had a problem here.
Three astronauts in grave danger.
It looks grim. Yes, it does.
As space exploration becomes a life or death situation.
We're not going to the moon anymore. We're going to just be damn lucky to get home.
13 Minutes to the Moon returns with a story of a dramatic rescue mission.
You're 200,000 miles out. You're in a spacecraft that's dying.
The real story of Apollo 13.
I literally got on my knees and prayed.
13 Minutes to the Moon, Season 2.
We don't have much time.
From the BBC World Service.
One whole side of that spacecraft missing.
Search for 13 Minutes to the Moon wherever you get your podcasts.
That's the end right there.
And that's all from us for now, but there's going to be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles. Until next time, goodbye.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn 5 times the national average. Banking with Capital One means 5 times the savings toward your dream honeymoon, or 5 times the savings toward your family's ultimate vacation, even 5 times the savings toward just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member, FDIC.